the costs for selected patients. As of 1998, almost 200 people had taken part in the Lifestyle Project, and the results were phenomenal. After 1 year of treatment, 65% of patients had eliminated their chest pain. The effect was long-lasting as well. After 3 years, over 60% of the patients continued reporting no chest pain. As of 2011, nearly 4,000 patients have benefited from Dr. Ornish's program for reversing heart disease. The health benefits are equaled by the economic benefits. At the writing of the first edition of this book, over 1 million heart disease surgeries were being undertaken every year. In 2002, physician services and hospital care for heart disease patients cost $78.1 billion. That does not include drug costs, home health care, or nursing home care. In the 1990s, the angioplasty procedure alone cost $31,000, and bypass surgery cost $46,000. The cost has only risen since. In marked contrast, the year-long lifestyle intervention program only cost $7,000. By comparing the patients who underwent the lifestyle program with those patients who underwent the traditional route of surgery, Dr. Ornish and his colleagues demonstrated that the lifestyle intervention program cut costs by an average of $30,000 per patient, a success recognized by Medicare, which, as of January 2011, is now covering medical costs for patients who adopt Dr. Ornish's program. As of the writing of this second edition, however, a few updates to the state of heart disease treatment are in order. Although the total number of heart disease surgeries appears to be either the same or slightly smaller, the types of surgeries being performed have changed. Between 2001 to 2002 and 2007 to 2008, more invasive bypass operations declined by 38%, while angioplasty and stent placement operations remained approximately the same. Although there has been considerable discussion about which type of heart surgery best suits the cardiac patient, amid huge amounts of money being spent to compare surgical interventions, there has been virtually no serious discussion in the cardiology community about the possible use of dietary intervention to treat heart disease patients. This is a glaring omission, and considering the side effects and costs of stent and bypass operations, it is an undeniable tragedy perpetrated on the American public. Annually, thousands of Americans suffer adverse outcomes, including death, during these procedures. A stent operation costs from $11,000 to over $41,000, and a bypass costs $117,000, not including doctor fees, according to the American Heart Association. Compare all of this to the cost of Esselstyn's dietary advice, which may require as few as 5 hours of time and yield superior results, only $900 per session per person. When viewed nationwide, the costs continue to mount. The Telegraph reports that according to IMS Health, the cost of cholesterol-treating medicines, including statins, was estimated at $35 billion for 2010. And there's more. According to the American Heart Association, the total cost of treating heart disease is projected to rise from $273 billion in 2011 to $818 billion in 2030. Although much of this is due to an increasing number of people moving into ages where heart disease is more common. If the heart disease treatment community were a nation, this figure would make it the 27th richest among the world's almost 200 countries. This American Heart Association report, it should be noted, offers no new insight on how this rapidly growing business might be reversed through dietary lifestyle, except to advocate almost mundane population-based prevention programs like reducing dietary fat intakes and improving lipid levels, or personalized approaches to prevention that include assessments of genetic variants, biomarkers, and imaging modalities. And there is little or no evidence that these approaches have or can do anything to cause meaningful change. Clearly, much work remains to be done. The healthcare establishment is structured to profit from chemical and surgical intervention. Diet still takes the back seat to drugs and surgery, if it is mentioned to patients at all. One criticism that is constantly leveled at the dietary argument is that patients will not make such fundamental changes. One doctor charges that Dr. Esselstein's patients change their eating habits simply because of Esselstein's zealous belief. This criticism is not only wrong and insulting to patients and Dr. Esselstein, it is also self-fulfilling. If doctors do not believe that patients will change their diets, they will neglect to talk about diet, or will do it in an offhanded, disparaging way. There is no greater disrespect a doctor can show patients than that of withholding potentially life-saving information based on the assumption that patients do not want to change their lifestyle. Well-meaning institutions are not exempt from such closed-mindedness. The American Heart Association recommends a diet for heart disease that favors moderation. The National Cholesterol Education Program does the same thing. These organizations pitch moderate diets with trivial changes as being healthy lifestyle goals. If you are at high risk for heart disease, or if you already have the disease, they recommend that you adopt a diet containing 30% of total calories as fat, 7% of total calories as saturated fat, and less than 200 milligrams per day of dietary cholesterol. According to them, we should also keep our total blood cholesterol level under the desirable level of 200 milligrams per deciliter. These venerable organizations are not giving the American public the most up-to-date scientific information. While we are told that a total blood cholesterol level of 200 milligrams per deciliter is desirable, we know that 35% of heart attacks strike Americans who have cholesterol levels between 150 and 200 milligrams per deciliter. A truly safe cholesterol level is under 150 milligrams per deciliter. We also know that the most aggressive reversal of heart disease ever demonstrated occurred when fat was about 10% of total calorie intake. Studies have clearly demonstrated that many patients who follow the more moderate government-recommended diets see a progression of heart disease. The innocent victims are health-conscious Americans who follow these recommendations, keeping their total cholesterol around 180 or 190 milligrams per deciliter, only to be rewarded with a heart attack, leading to a premature death. To top it off, the National Cholesterol Education Program dangerously writes, "Lifestyle changes are the most cost-effective means to reduce risk for CHD, coronary heart disease. Even so, to achieve maximal benefit, many persons will require LDL cholesterol-lowering drugs." No wonder America's health is failing. The dietary recommendations for the most diseased hearts among us, given by supposedly reputable institutions, are severely watered down and followed by the caveat that we'll probably need a lifetime of drugs anyway. Our leading organizations fear that if they advocate more than modest changes, no one will listen to them. But the establishment-recommended diets are not nearly as healthy as the diets espoused by Drs. Esselstein and Ornish. The fact is that a blood cholesterol level of 200 milligrams per deciliter is not optimal. A 30% fat diet is not low fat, and eating foods containing any cholesterol above 0 milligrams is unhealthy. Our health institutions are intentionally misleading the public about heart disease, all in the name of moderation. Whether scientists, doctors, and policymakers think the public will change or not, the layperson must be aware that a whole foods, plant-based WFPB diet is far and away the healthiest diet. In the seminal paper regarding the landmark lifestyle heart trial, the authors, Dr. Ornish and his scientific colleagues, write, "The point of our study was to determine what is true, not what is practicable. We now know what is true. A WFPB diet can prevent and treat heart disease, saving hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. Dr. William Castelli, a longtime director of the Framingham Heart Study, a cornerstone of heart disease research, espouses a WFPB diet. Dr. Esselstein, who has demonstrated the most significant reversal of heart disease in all of medical history, espouses a WFPB diet. Dr. Ornish, who has pioneered reversal of heart disease without drugs or surgery and proved widespread economic benefit for patients and insurance providers, espouses a WFPB diet. Since writing the first edition of this book, I have encountered dozens more doctors who have recommended to their heart patients a WFPB diet and who have, as Drs. Esselstein and Ornish did, observed spectacular results. Although their numbers are still tiny compared to the full cardiology field, there are far more of them than I knew, and those numbers are growing. Now is a time of great hope and challenge, a time when people can control their health. One of the best and most caring doctors I have ever met puts it best. The collective conscience and will of our profession is being tested as never before. Now is the time for us to have the courage for legendary work. Dr. Caldwell B. Esselstein, Jr. Chapter 6. Obesity. Perhaps you've heard the news. Perhaps you've caught a glimpse of the staggering statistics on obesity among Americans. Perhaps you've simply noticed that, compared to a few years ago, more people at the grocery store are overweight. Perhaps you've been in classrooms, on playgrounds, or at daycare centers, and noticed how many kids are already burdened with a weight problem and can't run 20 feet without getting winded. Our struggle with weight is hard to miss these days. Open a newspaper or a magazine, or turn on the radio or TV, you know that America has a weight problem. In fact, more than 2 out of 3 adult Americans are at least overweight. 1/3 of the adult population is obese. Not only are these numbers high, but the rate at which they have been rising is ominous. See chart 1.2, page 5. But what do the terms overweight and obese mean? The standard expression of body size is the body mass index, BMI. It represents body weight, in kilograms, kg, relative to body height, in meters squared, m to the second power. By most official standards, being overweight is having a BMI above 25, and being obese is having a BMI over 30. The same scale is used for both men and women. You can determine your own BMI using chart 6.1, which lists the necessary information in pounds and inches for your convenience. The children. Perhaps the most depressing element of our supersize mess is the growing number of overweight and obese children. About 18% of 6 to 11-year-olds and 21% of 12 to 19-year-olds in America are overweight. Another 15% are at risk of becoming overweight. Overweight children face a wide range of psychological and social challenges. As you know, children have a knack for being open and blunt. Sometimes the playground can be a merciless place. Overweight children find it more difficult to make friends and are often thought of as lazy and sloppy. They are more likely to have behavioral and learning difficulties, and the low self-esteem likely to be formed during adolescence can last forever. Young people who are overweight also are highly likely to face a host of medical problems. They often have elevated cholesterol levels, which can be a predictor for any number of deadly diseases. They are more likely to have problems with glucose intolerance and, consequently, diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, formerly seen only in adults, is skyrocketing among adolescents. See chapters 7 and 9 for a more thorough discussion of childhood diabetes. Elevated blood pressure is 9 times more likely to occur among obese kids. Sleep apnea, which can cause neurocognitive problems, is found in 1 in 10 obese children. A wide variety of bone problems is more common in obese kids. More importantly, an obese young person is much more likely to be an obese adult, greatly increasing the likelihood of lifelong health problems. Consequences for the adult. If you are obese, you may not be able to do many things that could make your life more enjoyable. You may find that you cannot play vigorously with your grandchildren or your children, walk long distances, participate in sports, find a comfortable seat in a movie theater or airplane, or have an active sex life. In fact, even sitting still in a chair may be impossible without experiencing back or joint pain. For many, standing is hard on the knees. Carrying around too much weight can dramatically affect physical mobility, work, mental health, self-perception, and social life. So you see, this isn't about death. It really is about missing many of the more enjoyable things in life. Clearly, no one desires to be overweight. So why is it that 2 out of 3 adult Americans are overweight? Why is 1/3 of the population obese? The problem is not a lack of money. In 1999, medical care costs relating to obesity alone were estimated to be $70 billion. In 2002, a mere 3 years later, the American Obesity Association listed these costs at $100 billion. By 2006, obesity-related medical treatment costs reached between $147 and $210 billion. This is not all. Add another $60 billion or more out-of-pocket expenses that we spend trying to keep off the weight in the first place. Going on special weight loss diet plans and popping pills to cut our appetites or rearrange our metabolism have become a national pastime. This is an economic black hole that sucks our money away without offering anything in return. Imagine paying $40 to a plumber to fix your leaky kitchen sink, and then 2 weeks later, the sink pipes explode and flood the kitchen, and it costs $500 to repair. I bet you wouldn't ask that plumber to fix your sink again. So then why do we endlessly try those weight loss plans, books, drinks, energy bars, and assorted gimmicks when they don't deliver as promised? I applaud people for trying to achieve a healthy weight. I don't question the worthiness or dignity of overweight people any more than I question cancer victims. My criticism is of a societal system that allows and even encourages this problem. I believe, for example, that we are drowning in an ocean of very bad information, too much of it intended to put money into someone else's pockets. What we really need, then, is a new solution featuring good information for individual people to use at a price that they can afford. The solution. The solution to losing weight is a whole foods, plant-based, WFPB diet, coupled with a reasonable amount of exercise. It is a long-term lifestyle change rather than a quick-fix fad, and it can provide sustained weight loss while minimizing risk of chronic disease. Have you ever known anyone who regularly consumes fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grain foods, and rarely, if ever, consumes meats or junk foods like chips, French fries, and candy bars? What is his or her weight like? If you know many people like this, you have probably noticed that they tend to have a healthy weight. Now think of traditional cultures around the world. Think of traditional Asian cultures, Chinese, Japanese, Indian, where a couple of billion people have been eating a mostly plant-based diet for thousands of years. It's hard to imagine these people, at least until recently, as anything other than slender. Now, imagine a guy buying 2 hot dogs and ordering his 2nd beer at a baseball game, or a woman ordering a cheeseburger and fries at your local fast food joint. The people in these images look different, don't they? Unfortunately, the guy munching his hot dogs and sipping his beer is the all-American image. I have had visitors from other countries tell me that one of the first things they notice when they arrive in our good land is the exceptional number of fat people. Solving this problem does not require magic tricks or complex equations involving blood types or carbohydrate counting or soul searching. Simply trust your observations on who is slim, vigorous, and healthy, and who is not. Or trust the findings of some impressive research studies, large and small, showing time and time again that vegetarians and vegans are slimmer than their meat-eating counterparts. People in these studies who are vegetarian or vegan are anywhere from 5 to 30 pounds slimmer than their fellow citizens. In one intervention study, overweight subjects were told to eat as much as they wanted of foods that were mostly low-fat, whole foods, and plant-based. In 3 weeks, these people lost an average of 17 pounds. At the Pritikin Center, 4,500 patients who had gone through their 3-week program got similar results. By feeding a mostly plant-based diet and promoting exercise, the center found that its clients lost 5.5% of their body weight over 3 weeks. Published results for still more intervention studies using a low-fat, whole foods, mostly plant-based diet. Here are published results for still more intervention studies using a low-fat, whole foods, mostly plant-based diet. About 2 to 5 pounds lost after 12 days. About 10 pounds lost in 3 weeks. 16 pounds lost over 12 weeks. 24 pounds lost after 1 year. All of these results show that consuming a WFPB diet will help you to lose weight, and furthermore, it can happen quickly. The only question is how much weight you can lose. In most of these studies, the people who shed the most pounds were those who started with the most excess weight. After the initial weight loss, the weight can be kept off for the long term by staying on the diet. Most importantly, losing weight this way is consistent with long-term health. Some people, of course, can be on a plant-based diet and still not lose weight. There are a few very good reasons for this. First and foremost, losing body weight on a plant-based diet is much less likely to occur if the diet includes too many refined carbohydrates. Sweets, pastries, and pastas won't do it. These foods are high in readily digested sugars and starches, and for the pastries, oftentimes very high in fat as well. As mentioned in Chapter 4, these highly processed, unnatural foods are not part of a plant-based diet that works to reduce body weight and promote health. This is one of the main reasons that I usually refer to the optimal diet as a whole foods, plant-based diet. Notice that a strict vegetarian diet is not necessarily the same thing as a WFPB diet. Some people become vegetarian only to replace meat with dairy foods, added oils, and refined carbohydrates, including pasta made with refined grains, sweets, and pastries. I refer to these people as junk food vegetarians because they are not consuming a nutritious diet. The second reason weight loss may be elusive is if a person never engages in any physical activity. A reasonable amount of physical activity sustained on a regular basis can pay important dividends. Thirdly, certain people have a family predisposition for overweight bodies that may make their challenge more difficult. If you are one of these people, I can only say that you probably need to be especially rigorous in your diet and exercise. In rural China, we noticed that obese people simply did not exist, even though Chinese immigrants in Western countries do succumb to obesity. Now, as the dietary and lifestyle practices of people in China are becoming more like ours, so, too, have their bodies become more like ours. Amazing as it may seem, China is now number 2 behind the U.S. in number of obese people, and this has happened in a very short period of time. For those with genetic predispositions, it doesn't take much bad food before their change in diet starts to cause problems. Keeping body weight off successfully should be part of a long-term lifestyle. Gimmicks that produce impressively large, quick weight losses often don't work in the long term. Short-term gains should not come along with long-term pain, like kidney problems, heart disease, cancer, bone and joint ailments, and other problems that may be brought on with popular diet fads. If the weight was gained slowly, over a period of months and years, why would you expect to take it off healthily in a matter of weeks? Treating weight loss as a race doesn't work. It only makes the dieter more eager to quit the diet and go back to the eating habits that put them in need of losing weight in the first place. One very large study of 21,105 vegetarians and vegans found that body mass index was lower among those who had adhered to their diet for 5 or more years, compared to people who had been on the diet for less than 5 years. Why this will work for you. So, there is a solution to the weight gain problem. But how can you apply it to your own life? First of all, throw away ideas about counting calories. Generally speaking, you can eat as much as you want and still lose weight, as long as you eat the right type of food. See Chapter 12 for details. Secondly, stop expecting sacrifice, deprivation, or blandness. There's no need. Feeling hungry is a sign that something is wrong, and prolonged hunger causes your body to slow the overall rate of metabolism in defense. Moreover, there are mechanisms in our bodies that naturally allow the right kind of plant-based foods to nourish us, without our having to think about every morsel of food we put in our mouths. It is a worry-free way to eat. Give your body the right food, and it will do the right thing. In some studies, those who follow a whole foods, low-fat, plant-based diet consume fewer calories. It's not because they're starving themselves. In fact, they will likely spend more time eating and eat a larger volume of food than their meat-eating counterparts. That's because fruits, vegetables, and grains, as whole foods, are much less energy-dense than animal foods and added fats. There are fewer calories in each spoonful or cupful of these foods. Remember that fat has 9 calories per gram, while carbohydrates and protein have only 4 calories per gram. In addition, whole fruits, vegetables, and grains have a lot of fiber, which makes you feel full, and yet contribute relatively small amounts of calories to your meal. So by eating a healthy meal, you may reduce the calories that you consume, digest, and absorb, even if you eat significantly more food. This idea on its own, however, is not yet a sufficient explanation for the benefits of a WFPB diet. The same criticisms I made against the Atkins diet and the other popular low-carb diets, Chapter 4, can also be applied to short-term studies in which subjects consume fewer calories while eating a plant-based diet. Over the long term, these subjects will find it very difficult to continue consuming an abnormally low level of calories. Weight loss due to calorie restriction rarely leads to long-term weight loss. This is why other studies play such a crucial part in explaining the health benefits of a WFPB diet. These studies show that the weight loss is due to more than simple calorie restriction. These studies document the fact that vegetarians consume the same amount or even significantly more calories than their meat-eating counterparts, and yet are still slimmer. The China study demonstrated that rural Chinese consuming a plant-based diet actually consumes significantly more calories per pound of body weight than Americans. Most people would automatically assume that these rural Chinese would therefore be heavier than their meat-eating counterparts. But here's the kicker. The rural Chinese are still slimmer while consuming a greater volume of food and more calories. Much of this effect is undoubtedly due to greater physical activity. But this comparison is between average Americans and the least active Chinese, those who do office work. Furthermore, studies done in Israel and the United Kingdom, neither of which represent primarily agrarian cultures, also show that vegetarians may consume the same or significantly more calories and still weigh less. What's the secret? One factor that I've mentioned previously is the process of thermogenesis, which refers to our production of body heat during metabolism. Vegetarians have been observed to have a slightly higher rate of metabolism during rest, meaning they burn up slightly more of their ingested calories as body heat rather than depositing them as body fat. A relatively small increase in metabolic rate translates to a large number of calories burned over the course of 24 hours. Most of the scientific basis for the importance of this phenomenon was presented in Chapter 4 and in a research publication of my own. Exercise. The slimming effect of physical activity is obvious. Scientific evidence concurs. A recent review of all the credible studies compared the relationship between body weight and exercise and showed that people who were more physically active had less body weight. Another set of studies showed that exercising on a regular basis helped to keep off weight originally lost through exercise programs. No surprise here, either. Starting and stopping an exercise program is not a good idea. It is better to build it into your lifestyle so that you will become and continue to be more fit overall, not just burn off calories. How much exercise is needed to keep the pounds off? A rough estimate derived from a good review suggested that exercising a mere 15 to 45 minutes per day, every day, will maintain a body weight that is 11 to 18 pounds lighter than it would otherwise be. Interestingly, we should not forget our spontaneous physical activity, the kind that is associated with chores of daily life. This can account for 100 to 800 calories per day. People who are regularly up and about doing physical things are going to be well ahead of those who get trapped in a sedentary lifestyle. The advantages of combining diet and exercise to control body weight were brought home to me by a very simple study involving our experimental animals. Recall that our experimental animals were fed diets containing either the traditional 20% casein, cow's milk protein, or the much lower 5% casein. The rats consuming the 5% casein diets had strikingly less cancer, lower blood cholesterol, and longer lives. They also consumed slightly more calories, but burned them off as body heat. Some of us had noticed over the course of these experiments that the 5% casein animals seemed to be more active than the 20% casein animals. To test this idea, we housed rats fed either 5% or 20% casein diets in cages equipped with exercise wheels, outfitted with meters to record the number of turns of the wheel. Within the very first day, the 5% casein-fed animals voluntarily exercised in the wheel about twice as much as the 20% casein-fed animals. Exercise remained considerably higher for the 5% casein animals throughout the 2 weeks of the study. Now we can combine some really interesting observations on body weight. A plant-based diet operates on calorie balance to keep body weight under control in two ways. First, it discharges calories as body heat instead of storing them as body fat, and it doesn't take many calories to make a big difference over the course of a year. Second, a plant-based diet encourages more physical activity, and as body weight goes down, it becomes easier to be physically active. Diet and exercise work together to decrease body weight and improve overall health. Going in the right direction. Obesity is the most ominous harbinger of poor health that Western nations currently face. Tens of millions of people will fall prey to disability, putting our healthcare systems under greater strain than has previously been seen. There are many people and institutions working to reduce this problem, but their point of attack is often illogical and misinformed. First, there are the many quick-fix promises and gimmicks. Obesity is not a condition that can be fixed in a few weeks or even a few months, and you should beware of diets, potions, and pills that create rapid weight loss with no promise of good health in the future. The diet that helps to reduce weight in the short run needs to be the same diet that creates and maintains health in the long run. Second, the tendency to focus on obesity as an independent, isolated disease is misplaced. Considering obesity in this manner directs our attention to a search for specific cures, while ignoring control of the other diseases to which obesity is strongly linked. That is, we sacrifice context. Also, I would urge that we ignore the suggestion that knowing its genetic basis might control obesity. A few years ago, there was great publicity given to the discovery of the obesity gene. Then there was the discovery of a second gene related to obesity, and a third gene, and a fourth, and on and on. The purpose behind the obesity gene search is to allow researchers to develop a drug capable of knocking out or inactivating the underlying cause of obesity. This is extremely short-sighted, as well as unproductive. Believing that specific identifiable genes are the basis of obesity, that is, it's all in the family, also allows us to fatalistically blame a cause that we cannot control. I find it tragic that although the topic of obesity has been researched so long, an explanation is still so far away. PubMed, the search engine for the U.S. National Library of Medicine, reveals approximately 3,700 obesity research reviews, representing 246,000 individual research publications. Each conceivable perspective on this disease seems to have been investigated, from its biological cause to its genetic basis, prevalence in the world, costs to society, reversal, and relationship to personal behaviors. And in spite of this unfathomable amount of research, there has been very little progress in our efforts to bring this disease under control. It seems to have done little to stymie obesity's progression over time and into every society that chooses the Western diet. Much of this research has sprung from the notion that obesity is an independent disease, formalized with its own specific medical code, a classification choice that was the subject of considerable discussion more than two decades ago. Arguments in favor were that a specific identity would facilitate its diagnosis and treatment, as well as insurance reimbursement. Arguments against were that obesity is primarily a symptom of a constellation of highly correlated, interrelated, degenerative diseases and ailments typically observed among people consuming a Western diet. Treating obesity in isolation means ignoring associated diseases that have been shown to arise from the same dietary cause. But while the science may be complex, the practical answer is simple. We can control the cause. It is right at the end of our fork. Chapter 7. Diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, the most common form, often accompanies obesity. As we, as a nation, continue to gain weight, our rate of diabetes spirals out of control. In the 8 years from 1990 to 1998, the incidence of diabetes increased 33%. As of 1998, over 8% of American adults were diabetic. As of 2012, 9.3% of adults were diabetic, and over 200,000 kids under 20 had diabetes, though this latter figure includes both types 1 and 2. That translates to more than 29.1 million Americans. The scariest figure? Just under one-third of those people with diabetes didn't yet know that they had it. You know the situation is serious when our children, at the age of puberty, start falling prey to the form of diabetes usually reserved for adults over 40. One newspaper recently illustrated the epidemic with the story of a girl who weighed 350 pounds at the age of 15, had the adult-onset form of diabetes, and was injecting insulin into her body 3 times a day. What is diabetes? Why should we care about it? And how do we stop it from happening to us? Two faces of the same devil. Almost all cases of diabetes are either type 1 or type 2. Type 1 develops in children and adolescents, and thus is sometimes referred to as juvenile onset diabetes. This form accounts for 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases. Type 2, which accounts for 90 to 95% of all cases, used to occur primarily in adults age 40 and up, and thus was called adult onset diabetes. But because up to 45% of new diabetes cases in children are type 2 diabetes, the age-specific names are being dropped, and the two forms of diabetes are simply referred to as type 1 and type 2. In both types, the disease begins with dysfunctional glucose metabolism. Normal metabolism goes like this. We eat food. The food is digested, and the carbohydrate part is broken down into simple sugars, much of which is glucose. Glucose, blood sugar, enters the blood, and insulin is produced by the pancreas to manage its transport and distribution around the body. Insulin, acting like an usher, opens doors for glucose into different cells for a variety of purposes. Some of the glucose is converted to short-term energy for immediate cell use, and some is stored as long-term energy, fat, for later use. As a person develops diabetes, this metabolic process collapses. Type 1 diabetics cannot produce adequate insulin because the insulin-producing cells of their pancreas have been destroyed or are dysfunctional. This is the result of the body attacking itself, making type 1 diabetes an autoimmune disease. Type 1 diabetes and other autoimmune diseases are discussed in Chapter 9. Type 2 diabetics can produce insulin, but the insulin doesn't do its job effectively. Once the insulin starts giving orders to dispatch the blood sugar into cells, the body doesn't pay attention, and the blood sugar is not metabolized properly. This is called insulin resistance. Imagine your body is an airport, complete with vast parking areas. Each unit of your blood sugar is an individual traveler. After you eat, your blood sugar rises. In our analogy, then, that means lots of travelers would start to arrive at the airport. The people would drive in, park in a lot, and walk to the stop where the shuttle bus is supposed to pick them up. As your blood sugar continues to rise, all the airport parking lots would fill to capacity, and all the people would congregate at the shuttle bus stops. The shuttle buses, of course, represent insulin. In the diabetic airport, unfortunately, there are all sorts of problems with the buses. In the type 1 diabetic airport, the shuttle buses simply don't exist. The only shuttle bus manufacturer in the known universe, Pancreas Company, was shut down. In the type 2 diabetic airport, there are some shuttle buses, but they don't work very well. In both cases, travelers never get to where they want to go. The airport system breaks down and chaos ensues. In real life, this corresponds with a rise in blood sugar to dangerous levels. In fact, diabetes is diagnosed by the observation of elevated blood sugar levels, or its spillage into urine. What are the long-term health risks of glucose metabolism being disrupted? Here's a summary taken from a Centers for Disease Control report. The italicized data are recent statistics, added in this second edition. The other data are from the first edition. Diabetes complications. Heart disease. 2 to 4 times the risk of death from heart disease. Recent statistics. 1.8 times the risk of heart disease. Stroke. 2 to 4 times the risk of stroke. Recent statistics. 1.5 times the risk of stroke. High blood pressure. Over 70% of people with diabetes have high blood pressure. Blindness. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in adults. Recent statistics. 28.5% of diabetics have retinopathy that may lead to loss of vision. Kidney disease. Diabetes is the leading cause of end-stage kidney disease. In 1999, over 100,000 diabetics underwent dialysis or kidney transplantation, recent statistics, in 2011, there were 228,924 cases of diabetes-related kidney failure in those on chronic dialysis or who had undergone kidney transplant. Nervous system disease. 60 to 70% of diabetics suffer mild to severe nervous system damage. Amputation. Over 60% of all lower limb amputations occur with diabetics. Dental disease. Increased frequency and severity of gum disease that can lead to tooth loss. Pregnancy complications. Increased susceptibility to other illnesses. Death. Modern drugs and surgery offer no cure for diabetics. At best, current drugs allow diabetics to maintain a reasonably functional lifestyle. But these drugs will never treat the cause of the disease. As a consequence, diabetics face a lifetime of drugs and medications, making diabetes an enormously costly disease. The economic toll of diabetes in the U.S., over $245 billion a year in 2013, up from $130 billion in 2000. But there is hope. In fact, there is much more than hope, if we simply keep an open mind. The food we eat has enormous influence over this disease. The right diet not only prevents, but also treats diabetes. What, then, is the right diet? You can probably guess what I'm going to say, but let the research speak for itself. Now you see it, now you don't. Like most chronic diseases, diabetes shows up more often in some parts of the world than in others. This has been known for 100 years. It has also been well documented that those populations with low rates of diabetes eat different diets than those populations with high rates of diabetes. But is that just a coincidence, or is there something else at work? About 90 years ago, H.P. Himsworth compiled all the existing research in a report comparing diets and diabetes rates in 6 countries. What he found was that some cultures were consuming high-fat diets, while others had diets high in carbohydrates. These fat versus carbohydrate consumption patterns were the result of animal versus plant food consumption. Chart 7.1 documents the diet and disease conditions for these countries in the early part of the 20th century. As carbohydrate intake goes up and fat intake goes down, the number of deaths from diabetes plummets from 20.4 to 2.9 per 100,000 people. The verdict? A high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet, a plant-based diet, is unmistakably associated with lower rates of diabetes. 30 years later, the question was re-examined. After examining 4 countries from Southeast Asia and South America, researchers again found that high-carbohydrate diets were linked to low rates of diabetes. Researchers noted that the country with the highest rate of diabetes, Uruguay, had a diet that was typically Western in character, being high in calories, animal protein, total fat, and animal fat. Countries with low rates of diabetes used a diet that was relatively lower in protein, particularly animal protein, fat, and animal fat. A high proportion of calories is derived from carbohydrates, particularly from rice. These same researchers enlarged their study to 11 countries through Central and South America and Asia. The strongest association they found with diabetes was excess weight. Populations eating the most Western type of diet also had the highest cholesterol levels, which in turn was strongly associated with the rate of diabetes. Is this starting to sound familiar? Within one population. These old cross-cultural studies can be crude, resulting in conclusions that are not entirely reliable. Perhaps the difference in diabetes rates in the previous studies was not due to diet, but to genetics. Perhaps other unmeasured cultural factors, like physical activity, were more relevant. A better test would be a study of diabetes rates in a single population. The Seventh-day Adventists' population is a good example. They are an interesting group of people to study because of their dietary habits. Their religion encourages them to stay away from meat, fish, eggs, coffee, alcohol, and tobacco. As a result, half of them are vegetarian. But 90% of these vegetarians still consume dairy and/or egg products, thus deriving a significant amount of their calories from animal sources. It should also be noted that the meat-eating Adventists are not the meatiest of eaters. They consume about 3 servings of beef a week, and less than 1 serving a week of fish and poultry. I know plenty of people who consume this amount of meat, including fish and poultry, every 2 days. In dietary studies involving the Adventists, scientists compare moderate vegetarians to moderate meat eaters. This is not a big difference. Even so, the Adventist vegetarians are much healthier than their meat-eating counterparts. Those Adventists that deprive themselves of meat also deprive themselves of the ravages of diabetes. Compared to the meat-eaters, the vegetarians had about one-half the rate of diabetes. They also had almost half the rate of obesity. In another study, scientists measured diets and diabetes in a population of Japanese-American men in Washington State. These men were the sons of Japanese immigrants to the U.S. Remarkably, they had more than 4 times the prevalence of diabetes than the average rate found in similar-aged men who stayed in Japan. So, what happened? Those Japanese Americans who developed diabetes also ate the most animal protein, animal fat, and dietary cholesterol, each of which is only found in animal-based foods. Total fat intake also was higher among the diabetics. These same dietary characteristics also resulted in excess weight. These second-generation Japanese Americans ate a meatier diet with less plant-based food than men born in Japan. The researchers wrote, "Apparently, the eating habits of Japanese men living in the United States resemble more the American eating style than the Japanese." The consequence: 4 times as much incidence of diabetes. Some other studies. Researchers found that increased fat intake was associated with an increased rate of type 2 diabetes among 1,300 people in the San Luis Valley in Colorado. They said, "The findings support the hypothesis that high-fat, low-carbohydrate diets are associated with the onset of non-insulin-dependent, type 2, diabetes mellitus in humans." In a recent 25-year period, the rate at which children in Japan contracted type 2 diabetes had more than tripled. Researchers noted that consumption of animal protein and animal fat had drastically increased in the past 50 years. They said that this dietary shift, along with low exercise levels, might be to blame for this explosion of diabetes. In England and Wales, the rate of diabetes markedly dropped from 1940 to 1950, largely during World War II, when food consumption patterns changed markedly. During the war and its aftermath, fiber and grain intake went up, and fat intake went down. People ate lower on the food chain because of national necessity. Around 1950, though, people gave up the grain-based diets and returned to eating more fat, more sugar, and less fiber. Sure enough, diabetes rates started going up. Researchers studied 36,000 women in Iowa for 6 years. All were free of diabetes at the start of the study, but more than 1,100 cases of diabetes developed after 6 years. The women who were least likely to get diabetes were those that ate the most whole grains and fiber, those whose diets contained the most carbohydrates, the complex kind found in whole foods. All of these findings support the idea that both across and within populations, high-fiber, whole, plant-based foods protect against diabetes, and high-fat, high-protein, animal-based foods promote diabetes. Curing the incurable. All of the research just cited was observational, and an observed association, even if frequently seen, may only be an incidental association that masks the real cause-effect relationship of environment, including diet and disease. There is, however, also research of the controlled or intervention variety. This involves changing the diets of people who already have either full-blown type 1 or type 2 diabetes or mild diabetic symptoms, impaired glucose tolerance. James Anderson, M.D., is one of the most prominent scientists to have studied diet and diabetes in recent decades, garnering dramatic results using dietary means alone. One of his studies examined the effects of a high-fiber, high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet on 25 type 1 diabetics and 25 type 2 diabetics in a hospital setting. None of his 50 patients were overweight, and all of them were taking insulin shots to control their blood sugar levels. His experimental diet consisted mainly of whole plant foods and the equivalent of only a cold cut or two of meat a day. He put his patients on the conservative American-style diet recommended by the American Diabetes Association for 1 week and then switched them over to the experimental veggie diet for 3 weeks. He measured their blood sugar levels, cholesterol levels, weight, and medication requirements. The results were impressive. Type 1 diabetics cannot produce insulin. It is difficult to imagine any dietary change that might aid their predicament. But after just 3 weeks, the type 1 diabetes patients were able to lower their insulin medication by an average of 40%. Their blood sugar profiles improved dramatically. Just as importantly, their cholesterol levels dropped by 30%. Remember, one of the dangers of being diabetic is the secondary outcomes, heart disease and stroke. Lowering risk factors for those secondary outcomes by improving the cholesterol profile is almost as important as treating high blood sugar. Type 2 diabetics, unlike type 1, are more treatable because they haven't incurred such extensive damage to their pancreas. So the results from Anderson's type 2 patients on the high-fiber, low-fat diet were even more impressive. Of the 25 type 2 patients, 24 were able to discontinue their insulin medication. Let me say that again. All but one person were able to discontinue their insulin medication in a matter of weeks. One man had a 21-year history of diabetes and was taking 35 units of insulin a day. After 3 weeks of intensive dietary treatment, his insulin dosage dropped to 8 units a day. After 8 weeks at home, his need for insulin shots vanished. Chart 7.2 shows a sample of patients and how eating a plant-based diet lowered their insulin medications. This is a huge effect. In another study of 14 lean diabetic patients, Anderson found that diet alone could lower total cholesterol levels by 32% in just over 2 weeks. Some of the results are shown in Chart 7.3. These benefits, representing a decrease in blood cholesterol from 206 milligrams per deciliter to 141 milligrams per deciliter, are astounding, especially considering the speed with which they appear. Dr. Anderson also found no evidence that this cholesterol decrease was temporary as long as people continued on the diet. It remained low for 4 years. Another group of scientists at the Pritikin Center achieved equally spectacular results by prescribing a low-fat, plant-based diet and exercise to a group of diabetic patients. Of 40 patients on medication at the start of the program, 34 were able to discontinue all medication after only 26 days. This research group also demonstrated that the benefits of a plant-based diet will last for years if the same diet is continued. These are examples of some very dramatic research, but they only scratch the surface of all the supporting research that has been done. One scientific paper reviewed 9 publications citing the use of high-carbohydrate, high-fiber diets and 2 more standard carbohydrate, high-fiber diets to treat diabetic patients. All 11 studies resulted in improved blood sugar and cholesterol levels. Dietary fiber supplements, by the way, although beneficial, did not have the same consistent effects as a change to a whole